it's a correlator of it's a Green's function that has two vector currents and one axial current. And this is an object that has a very rich and interesting history, and it also an object which played an important role in our understanding of quantum field theory. Now, here is a list of things that, in one way or another, are connected to this correlator. It starts with the observation that the axial current in four dimensions is anomalous. It is related to the understanding that the axial anomaly in QCD is not renormalized, and the statement that is known now as Adler-Bardeen theorem. It is related, of course, to the understanding of how pions decay to two photons, and some indication, first indications, that there should be additional degrees of freedom, which we now refer to as colors. There is deep connection between this object and the anomaly matching condition due to Hooft and to the solution of the U1 problem in QCD. In perturbation theory, this correlator first appears at the one-loop level, and it is described by the two diagrams that you see here. These diagrams are known to have very peculiar behavior both in the ultraviolet and in the infrared, and this list of various phenomena that are listed here and features of this correlator that are listed here, in one way or the other, are related to the peculiar behavior of these diagrams in these exceptional momentum regions. Now, most of the things that you saw on the previous slide were studied and understood in 60s, 70s, and 80s, and so most of the things that we know about this correlator now come from that time. But recently, there was kind of a renewed interest in this Green's function, and it was to a large extent motivated by the need to understand certain type of electric contributions to the muon anomalous magnetic moment. Now, let me just remind you about what this what the electric contributions to the muon anomalous magnetic moment do. They come from sort of standard diagrams that we draw when we try to explain to students how the anomalous magnetic moments appear. But instead of the photon exchange between two muon lines, you now let Z or W be exchanged. Those one-loop diagrams change the anomalous magnetic moment by 200 times 10 to the minus 11, which is roughly comparable to the current discrepancy between theoretical prediction and the experimental measurement, and is also a factor of 3 larger than the uncertainty of the theoretical result. Now, in this situation, you would expect that the two-loop electric contributions to the muon anomalous magnetic moment are actually completely irrelevant, because if the one-loop contribution is about 200 times 10 to the minus 11, you would expect that the two-loop electric corrections would be a factor of 100 smaller. But it turns out not to be the case. And the two-loop electric corrections to the muon G minus 2 are roughly 25% of the lead order contribution, so about 50 times 10 to the minus 11. And for this reason, they are comparable to the current uncertainty in the theoretical prediction. So they are sufficiently large so that people so that people cared about them. Now, the reason these corrections are large is basically related to the fact that if you carefully inspect electric contributions, you will find electric diagrams, two-loop electric diagrams, you will find contributions that are enhanced by the ratio of the, let's say, Z or W mass to some small scale, mass scale in the problem. And usually this small scale in the problem would be the mass of the muon. However, there are classes of contributions, some of them similar to what we have here, where the infrared cutoff in these diagrams will be provided not by the muon or muon mass or lepton or some other lepton mass, but actually by the mass of the quark that you would have in this loop. In this case, explicit calculations show that diagrams like this exhibit very strong sensitivity to the infrared region of the loop momenta. And this sensitivity can be made explicit by introducing the constituent quark masses. Now, in this, for the diagrams like this, it is also useful to realize that this part of the diagram is sort of the Green's function that we are interested in, because due to Farris theorem, the vector part of the Z of the weak current that we have here completely decouples. It's only the axial part that is going to contribute here. And then we have the axial current, the vector current right here, and then another vector current that represents the external magnetic field. So if we introduce constituent quark masses to sort of probe the infrared sensitivity of this diagram, then we will get a result that you see here. It's a typical result, and you see that there is a significant sensitivity to the quark masses that we introduce. Now, now because this contribution is sufficiently large, and because people don't trust the constituent quark model too much, there was sort of a drive to try and understand this correlator a little bit better, and see whether or not the result that you derive in the constituent quark model can be actually either trusted or improved. Now, the second reason for, again, paying attention to this correlator in recent years comes from a separate contribution to the muon anomalous magnetic moment. It is basically a contribution that we usually refer to as hadronic light-by-light scattering. Hadronic light-by-light scattering comes from diagrams that are shown here. Again, this is the external magnetic field, and then there is a loop of hadrons that connects to the muon line by an exchange of three photons. So if you look at this contribution, of course, you don't see anywhere here the axial current. The contribution to hadronic light-by-light scattering is determined by the Green's function that contains four electromagnetic currents. And so the relation to the subject of this talk, which is the VVA correlator, is not apparent, but this relation appears if we look at this Green's function in a particular kinematics. Now, the kinematics that we need to look, that we need to study is what I would refer to as asymmetric. This is again the correlator of two electromagnetic currents. This is the magnetic field, so it's constant magnetic field. This is what we're interested in when we do, when we study anomalous magnetic moment. So the momentum transfer here is vanishingly small. In general, the the three momenta carried by these three remaining vector currents, electromagnetic currents, are arbitrary, but we will be interested in a situation where Q1 is of the same order as Q2, and both are much larger than Q3. So the large momentum in this diagram flows like this. Now, we also assume that still Q1 is of the same order as Q2, but both are much larger than Q3, and everything, each of these momenta are actually much larger than Q. So Q goes to zero is the limit that we take first. Now, in this situation, the sort of space-time picture of what is happening is such that these two vertices are very close to each other in space-time, and we can perform an operator product expansion of the product of two electromagnetic currents. This operator expansion, operator product expansion, is very well known, and you get the axial current out of it. So in this asymmetric kinematic region, when the large momentum flows like this, this four-point Green's function maps essentially on a three-point function that contains an axial current, a vector current, and another vector current that becomes soft. Now, of course, not all the contribution to the muon anomalous magnet, to the hadronic light-by-light scattering part of the muon G-2 comes from this asymmetric kinematic region, but it turns out that this kinematic region actually plays an important role. And so this in the final result. And so this, again, emphasizes the importance of understanding this contribution. There is sort of another important part of the story, which I should have emphasized, and I didn't, so I'll emphasize it right now, which is basically the following. We can try to map this various contributions, or connect these various contributions to the mu and g minus 2 to the correlator of two vectors and one axial current. And what we will see in this case is that sort of the importance of various momenta regions is basically momentum independent. So this means that if we want to calculate reliably this electric contribution to G minus 2 and harmonic light scattering contribution to G minus 2, we should understand equally well contributions coming from the low momentum region and the high momentum region. Okay, so basically we have some sort of logarithmic integrals, and they're coming from all the regions, and they don't have a region where the whole contribution is coming from. So this implies that if we talk about this VVA correlator, we need to understand it both at short distances and at long distances, and then put these things together in some consistent way. And of course, this is known to be a very difficult problem in QCD. We know how to deal with low Q squared QCD. This is chiral expansion. We know how to deal with large Q squared QCD. This is perturbation theory. But in the middle, we have to put these things together. This is the region where resonances appear, and this is where we don't have any good theoretical methods to describe or to deal with Green's functions. Now, interestingly, the holographic models of QCD, models that basically are referred to as ADS QCD models, provide some way of doing that, essentially connecting the low Q squared and high Q squared region in some unique way. Now, this was one of the important motivations for people to try to apply this holographic models to study the VVA correlator as needed for G minus 2. And of course, because these models are so popular in general, the ADS CFT studies are very popular, this became a huge industry. Many people started looking at this, many papers were written, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I can't comment on every possible calculation of this correlator in different holographic models, but I would like to basically point out one result that was obtained by Son and Yamamoto, who basically argued that there is a robust relation between the VVA correlator in a particular limit, namely when one of the vector currents is soft, and the difference of two-point correlators of the two vector and two axial currents properly normalized. So this is the relation, and these two functions of Q squared, we'll define shortly, but basically they describe, these are some form factors that uniquely defined the correlator of two vector and one axial current. Now, they argued that this relation is actually a sharp prediction of a holographic framework that is based on five-dimensional extension of Young-Mills and with additional Chern-Simons term. And the important point is that this relation appears if the chiral symmetry in this model is broken by boundary conditions. So if you break the chiral symmetry in some other way, this relation would not be valid. And so from their point of view, if this relation actually works in real QCD, this would allow to find or to select a better holographic model that will have a better relation to the real world QCD. Now, this relation, as we will see, is interesting regardless of its origin, and there were a lot of attempts where people tried to understand the validity of this relation in QCD. So this stimulated a significant activity in the field as well. Now, what I would like to discuss now are various things that we learned about this correlator starting from this in recent years. So this was sort of the motivation now, what we actually have learned. And I'll start describing what we know about this correlator in perturbation theory, because even in perturbation theory in recent years, we discovered some surprises. So let me now define exactly what I'll be talking about. I'll be talking about this correlator. A representative diagram is here. This is the axial current. This is the vector current. This is the other vector current. So vector and axial currents are defined in the usual way. They're quark bilinears. We assume that they have non-trivial structure in the flavor space. So this V hat and A hat basically represent some matrices in the flavor space that refer to vector couplings and axial vector couplings. So for example, if the vector current is electromagnetic current, then this will be a collection of electric charges. If this is the weak current, this will be a collection of weak charges. We will assume that the trace of this A hat is zero. This allows us to ignore ignore what is called a singlet contribution to this correlator. And this is basically useful because in this case, the anomaly equation becomes more complicated because of the operator mixing. So we'll ignore this issue completely. We'll look at a correlator that the axial currents that satisfy this property. And in this case, everything will become a little bit simpler. So we will look at the Fourier transform of the correlator that is written here. So Q1 and Q2 are the outgoing momenta that correspond to the vector current. It is useful to write this correlator in this factorized form where this trace of the product of A hat and two V hats basically takes care of the couplings that we might have for some specific vector and axial current. And this correlator, which we call W, basically refers to, basically describes these diagrams and is independent of a particular type of the currents that we consider. Now, we can take this correlator and ask the following question, and ask the question of how to write it in terms of some invariant form factors. We have constraints on this decomposition. Basically, QCD is parity conserving, so this needs to be accounted for. We need to make sure that the vector currents are conserved, and we also need to make sure that there is some type of Bose symmetry with respect to these two vector currents. So if we impose all of these conditions, we'll basically find that the correlator can be written in terms of four invariant form factors. One of these form factors is transverse. Three of these form factors, the ones that you see here, are transverse with respect to the momentum of the axial current. So if we contract this correlator with Q rho, and rho is the index of the Lorentz index of the axial current, then this form factor and this form factor and this form factor, I mean, this tends, this projected and this projected and this projected disappear. And there is one one tensor, which is referred here as T1, when this tensor is contracted with Q rho, it gives a non-vanishing contribution. So this is the corresponding form factor we'll refer to as the longitudinal form factor. So basically, out of these four, there were three transverse form factors and one longitudinal with respect to the momentum carried by the axial current. And all of these form factors independently are transversal with respect to the momentum carried by either of the vector current. Now, we know that the axial current satisfies the anomaly. Say this again.
That relation will hold independent of the triangle.
This decomposition.
Yeah,
it's a generic decomposition. Has nothing to do with the triangle. Just has something to do with the properties of the three currents, and the vector current conservation requirement. It is in, and the requirement that something happens if you interchange those two things. Now, we know that there is an anomaly equation, and which is written here, where F is the usual field strength tensor for the two vector currents, and F dual is the dual tensor. So if we translate this anomaly equation into the statement about the form factors that we introduced on the previous slide, we'll basically see that the contraction of this W tensor with the momentum that flows into the which is carried by the axial current should give us the quantity that you see on the right hand side. Now, we can translate this equation into the result for the longitudinal form factor. It is written here. And because of the Adler-Bardeen theorem, this equation is exact, and the longitudinal form factor will not receive any corrections in perturbation theory. So that's an exact result. So this was known, of course, for a very long time. There was nothing new here. An interesting question that one can ask in this respect, but of course it was not asked early enough, was what happens to this form factor? So we know that there is a unique result for the longitudinal form factor. And what about the three remaining ones? What about the three transversal form factors? If we start looking at those form factors in perturbation theory, do they receive any perturbative corrections? Can it be that some combinations of these form factors are actually protected from higher orders, from higher order perturbative corrections for some unknown reasons? Can something like this happen? Now, of course, sort of the generic answer to this question was that there is no symmetry that protects the transversal form factors, and so in general they should receive corrections, and as we will see in this statement is actually correct. But there is an interesting twist to this statement that I would like to describe. So it is useful to start looking at this problem by going back to what I refer to as soft limit for the vector current. So basically taking this correlator and then taking one of the momenta of the carried away by the vector, by taking one of the vector currents to carry very small, very soft momentum, I refer to it as k, then the axial current carries momentum q, the other vector current carries the momentum q minus k, and we'll try to write down an expression for this correlator that is accurate to first order in k. It is also convenient to introduce the polarization vector for this current. Sort of imagine that this corresponds to a photon, and basically assemble things in such a way that for this let's call it photon, for this photon, the correlator is explicitly proportional to the gauge invariant field strength tensor. Okay, so now in this case, up to first order in k, and all the k dependence is now in this field, in the dual field strength tensor. We can write a slightly different parameterization for this correlator, which now has only two form factors, WL and WT. Now, the one-loop calculation was done basically in the 60s. People calculated this WL, WT. And at one loop, there is a relationship between these two things. WL equals to twice WT. And, of course, WL is, again, given by this expression that we saw on the previous slide, which is basically the anomaly equation. Now, we know that this quantity is not normalized by high-order QCD effects. So this equals to that is the exact result. And recently, Weinstein argued that the second part of this equation, basically WT equals one-half of the right-hand side, is also the exact result in perturbative QCD, so that the relation between the longitudinal and the transversal form factors is exact and is not subject to higher order perturbative corrections. And I must say that all this that I have said so far applies to the situation where we're in the exact chiral limit. So all the quarks are massless, and
this statement is under some sort of Q. It does not apply to the higher order corrections that go like plus Q squared. So terms, the neglected terms that are higher order Q.
In K.
Sorry, K.
Yeah, we will see. So for now I'm working in this limit. If we include these terms, of course, there will be additional form factors, but we'll get there. So how we can prove this relation? How we can prove that WL equals to twice WT? Well, basically the idea is the following. Let's start with the correlator that you see here, and again the momentum assignment. Well, it is as shown. So this is the soft vector current, and this is the hard. This is the axial current, and this is the vector current with the hard momentum. So the idea is to basically take gamma phi from this vertex and try to move it all the way up to the vector current. Now, at the level of one loop diagram, it is clear that we have to basically start with gamma phi, then move past this propagator, and then move it past the gamma mu that we have here, so we need to commute gamma 5 with two gamma matrices. So nothing will change except that this index will become an axial index, the index of the axial current, and this Lorentz index will become the Lorentz index of the vector current, okay? Now, you can convince yourself that exactly the same thing happens in any order in perturbation theory. You add an extra gluon here, and you will have an extra propagate, and so on and so forth. So at each order in perturbation theory, you can play exactly the same game, and you will have to move the gamma 5. If you move the gamma 5 from this vertex to this vertex, you will have to anti-commute it with even number of gamma matrices. So at the end of the day, nothing will change. The only difference that one has to be careful about is the momentum flow assignment. The momentum Q is defined as incoming momentum when it must go into the flow, into the diagram following the axial current. And if we do this, then the Q will be outgoing momentum. So the equation that seems to emerge from these considerations is written here, where T mu nu is again this redefined correlator where one of the indices of the soft, where the index of the Lorentz index of the soft vector current is sort of absorbed into the polarization vector. So this is the equation that the sort of appears from these considerations, and in principle, one should say right away that somehow this line of arguing is not it cannot be absolutely correct. After all, the whole problem with the axial anomaly and related things can be traced to the fact that one has to introduce some regulator to define these diagrams properly, and whatever the regulator is introduced, it basically in one way or the other, it tells us about the difference between vector and axial current. So if it's dimensional regularization, then gamma 5 cannot just simply anti-commute with other gamma matrices. If it's Pauli Villars regularization, then there will be massive fermions in this diagram. And again, this idea that we only have even number of gamma matrices to anti-commute with becomes completely wrong. So this is an interesting sort of observation, but we should expect that something funny should be happening once we start checking it against the explicit parameterization of the correlate. And indeed, once we start doing that, we explicitly see that there is part of the correlator that does not satisfy this symmetry. To see this, we basically split this T mu nu to T mu rho, where mu is the vector index, rho is the axial Lorentz index, into three Lorentz structures that are now written down explicitly. And what we see is that if we interchain mu with rho, then this structure corresponds to that structure, this structure corresponds to that structure, but these two structures are basically the same, and they're not symmetric, they're actually anti-symmetric with respect to mu rho permutation, okay? So two out of three structures satisfy this condition perfectly. One structure doesn't work, okay? Now, what one should realize at this point is that in some sense we can completely forget about this third contribution and get it from the first two by requiring that the vector current is conserved. Okay? So this means that this term is indeed the subtraction term. Okay? It comes entirely from, for example, if you introduce massive fermions to define the anomalous correlation, it would come uniquely from that term. So you can also see this using the previous result for the transversal form factor, which goes like 1 over q squared. So this part of the story is completely q squared independent. Okay, it's really a local counterterm, if you wish. Now, what this means is that we understand why this happens, and we don't need this term to actually connect the longitudinal and transversal form factors. We only need these two. Okay? But for those two, we basically don't need any regularization, so to say. All right? And so if we force this symmetry on these two terms, on the first two terms, which have nothing to do with this subtraction that we must put in, okay, then we get this equation. that you see here, because this term must become that term if everything works properly. So we have this relation from which it follows that WL equals twice WT. And now, since the longitudinal form factor is protected from high-order QCD effects by Adler-Bardeen theorem, the above equation implies that the transverse form factor is also protected from high-order QCD effects, which means that in the soft, in the limit when one of the vector currents carries away a very small momentum, we have an exact prediction for the correlator of this three currents, exact in the sense of perturbative QCD. There are no corrections to this one, okay? Now, this by itself is a very cute result, I think, because there are not too many exact results in perturbative QCD that we have around, and this one is really simple and really exact. This is also F tilde. Tilde is missing, yeah. Yeah, F tilde is F with epsilon tilde, yes. Yeah, it's actually, it, the IF tilde is just the, it's this, yeah, so this is F tilde, sorry, it's F tilde. and also, this is also F tilde, of course. Yeah, so this is an exact result. Now, there are a couple of ways to sort of extend this result a little bit, and we can sort of move away from various limits that we were taking. And in particular, one of the interest, well, one of the sort of natural things to do is to move away from the soft limit. Because after all, if we want to play this game of anti-commuting gamma phi from one vertex to the other, we don't need the other current to be soft. Now, we can do this and then basically just do exactly the same. Take this gamma phi from here, move it up here. We get this equation between this correlator from that correlator where now axial current is here and vector current is here. And again, basically exactly the same logic applies, except now the momentum assignments are more complicated. Now we have minus Q1 coming in this direction and minus Q1, minus Q2 going over here. So if you put all this together, then this generic correlator that we have should satisfy this equation that you see here. So there is basically three things going on. One is that mu and rho are permuted on the right-hand side. Q and, well, the momenta assignments are changed according to this picture. And then there is this additional term which appears as the result of it's basically, this is the same subtraction terms, but now instead of doing the transformation and arguing that we have to ignore them, we can kind of put them in, assuming that these subtraction terms are only necessary. I mean, these subtraction terms appear at the one-loop level, the terms that are needed to define the correlator properly. Okay, so these guys appear at the one-loop level. This is the essence of the Adler-Bardeen theorem, and if we account for the way they transform under this mu to nu transformation, then we get this equation. So it is clear that if we try to use this equation. And now we'll try to apply this equation to the explicit to the correlators, to the explicit parameterization of the correlators that we introduced earlier. We will get some non-trivial relations between different form factors. Now there are three relations that one can write down following these results. They're written here. Now two of these, I think one should have minus here as well. So that's again a mistake. But basically, two of them involve transversal form factors that depend on whose arguments basically correspond, well, whose arguments are permuted, okay, following this vector axial interchange. So these two equations are not extremely illuminating, but there is one equation which is kind of interesting because this equation now involves some combinations of the transversal form factors and also the longitudinal form factor. Now, the longitudinal form factor we know. And so this provides a non-trivial constraint on the functional form of these functions, on the functional form of these form factors. Now, of course, this information is not sufficient to completely restore the functional form of these form factors, but these are fairly non-trivial relations that these guys have to satisfy. Now, we can see how the Weinstein's relation appears from these equations. Basically, if we now take Q2 to be zero, then Q1 squared becomes Q2 squared, becomes Q squared. So the first two equations, again, this plus should be minus, the first two equations are trivially satisfied. And the third equation can be satisfied, but only in the case when there is a relation between the longitudinal form factor and a linear combination of the two transversal form factors. So what we call WT in the decomposition of the form factor in the soft limit is in fact the linear combination of the two form factors that we introduced when we talked about general parametrization. Now, after these relations between form factors were discovered, people tried to test them by performing explicit tool calculations. And such calculations were done in 2005 by Yugalina and Tarasov. The calculation is not very simple. It involves 12 two-loop diagrams. And the non-trivial part of this is that these two-loop diagrams basically depend on three independent kinematic invariants, so Q1 squared, Q2 squared, Q3 squared, right? So the one-loop result was known, and here is the one-loop result written down explicitly for one of the form factors. So you basically see that the functions are actually sufficiently complicated, and if you would, so this is a one-loop result. So if you would imagine doing a two-loop result, okay, doing a two-loop calculation, then you normally should expect that the result will actually be pretty horrendous, okay? Now, I'm not sure why, what they were hoping for when they started doing this calculation, because, you know, at some point one has to calculate these integrals, and they're not pleasant. But they sort of pushed it far enough, and something interesting happened. So what happened is this. Instead of increased complexity, they basically discovered that the whole two-loop result is proportional to a one-loop result, okay? So the whole complexity disappeared remarkably, and the only remnant of these 12 diagrams was the one-loop correlator in its entirety multiplied by alpha s over pi times some coefficient. Now, the reason this multiplicative correction appeared, I can explain it in more detail, and I'll do this later. But for the time being, let's just say that it should not be there, because if this correction is there, then you're violating Adler-Bardeen theorem for the non-normalization of the anomaly. There is a longitudinal form factor here, and we know that longitudinal form factor shouldn't receive any higher order corrections. So this means that you have to get rid of this correction, and they get rid of this correction by renormalizing the axial current. You do a finite renormalization of the axial current, this correction goes away, but it's not only, but what goes away is not the correction to the longitudinal form factor now, it's a correction to the full correlator. So what you find by explicit two-loop calculation is that the full two-loop correction to this correlator vanishes. Now, if you take this together with the Weinstein's observation that in a soft limit, okay, there are no corrections to the correlator at all, it is very tempting to say that maybe the absence of corrections to this VVA correlator in the chiral limit is actually an exact property of perturbative QCD, and that if we are able to do these calculations to high orders, we will not find any corrections to the correlator of this recurrence. Okay, so they made this conjecture, and it is interesting to check it explicitly. Now, it is interesting that one can actually understand what is happening here from a slightly different perspective using a pretty old observation by someone called Schreier. So I think he was probably a student at MIT in 1971. Maybe a postdoc at MIT, I don't know. But he was basically playing with the following things back then. He was trying to understand what kind of restrictions on functional form of various two-point and three-point functions follow from conformal invariants. Okay? What he basically found is that you have a lot of restrictions of different types, but in particular, this VVA correlator is very significantly restricted if you allow for conformal invariants being the exact symmetry of the theory. He basically found out that the VVA correlator is one loop exact up to an overall renormalization factor that is obviously not fixed by any chiral symmetry. So now if we take this observation together with the statement that anomaly, that the longitudinal form factor should not be renormalized, okay, we basically come to the conclusion that this constant, proportionality constant that was not fixed in his study can be, you know, should not be there. It just should be one. There should be no dependence on it. I mean, this proportionality constant, this shouldn't be there. Now we can reformulate his observation by saying that to an extent that the VVA correlator is actual QCD, has something to do with, you know, with conformal invariants, right? We can say that the one loop result should be the exact result, as long as the conformal symmetry is a good symmetry in QCD. Now, of course, we know that in QCD, even in massless QCD, conformal symmetry is not a good symmetry, and we expect violation of these symmetries, but violations of the symmetries in QCD are ultimately related to the running of the coupling constant. Now,
so you're saying once you have loops on those gluons and the glue, then that's when you start noticing the running block.
Yeah, this is what I'm... Should I continue? But you basically said... Yeah, you got me. That's the problem. Okay, fine. Yes, so basically I'm saying that if we take this argument, okay, then seriously, then we can basically say that the reason these two loop corrections are absent is because for these diagrams you don't see anything which is related to the running of the coupling constant. So the reason so these corrections are absent is not that this is exact QCD result, but rather that the violation of the conformal symmetry for this particular observable is delayed. Okay. Now, how far is this delayed? Well, it is delayed to one loop higher, right? Because if you go to the third loop, you basically start having diagrams like this, and these diagrams are clearly related to the running of the coupling constant. So you would expect if the third loop is a crucial test. If at the third loop we don't find any corrections, then there is something deeper than just the observation by Schreier, which we don't at the moment understand. If we find corrections, on the other hand, then we will be pretty comfortable. We understand why there is no two-loop result. We understand why at three loops there is a correction. What also should happen is that all these 128 three-loop diagrams that we need to calculate get collected in such a way that the result is proportional to the one-loop QCD beta function. This is also not exactly a trivial statement by itself, okay? Now, the only remaining question is how to compute these 128 three-loop diagrams for these generic kinematics, and there is no known way one can do this you know, sort of keeping these dependencies on external momenta exactly, but one can get around this by applying some approximate methods. So the idea basically is of these approximate methods is basically related to the fact that there is a critical difference as far as our technical abilities are concerned. There is a critical difference between three-point functions and two-point functions. We know how to calculate three-loop contributions to essentially arbitrary two-point functions, and we don't know how to do this for the three-point function. So what we would like to do is to reduce the three-point function to a two-point function. Now, we can imagine how this reduction can happen. We basically, again, need to go back to this soft limit, essentially take an asymmetric configuration, taking one of the momenta to be much larger than the other. And in this case, it's intuitively clear that the calculation of this three-point function should somehow be reduced to a calculation of different two-point functions and its derivatives, because basically you can imagine that you should be able to tail respond in this momentum one way or the other. Now, of course, you cannot really tail respond, okay? You should do something more sophisticated, and this pretty much looks like an operator product expansion of some type, okay? Now, if you do this operator product expansion, you would basically map these three-point functions on two-point functions, and these two-point functions will kind of be of two different types. There will be two-point functions which will correspond to separation of these two points, which is very small, parametrically determined like by 1 over Q1. And there will be a separation of these two points, which is large, which is parametrically determined by 1 over Q2. Okay? In the language of operator product expansion, these are kind of perturbative corrections to Wilson coefficients, and these are corrections to the matrix elements. Of course, here everything is perturbative, so it's not that we are parameterizing, we are calculating this and parameterizing that. We are calculating everything, but this is basically the way to think about it. Now, it turns out that there is actually a pretty well-defined, pretty well-formulated algorithm of how one can proceed with these calculations in such a way that at any fixed loop order, so in particular in three loop order that we're interested in, we can systematically construct an expansion of this quantity in Q2 over Q1, essentially to an arbitrary, arbitrary order in this expansion, as long as, you know, our computers don't break down. So here is the recipe for doing that. It's relatively simple. You take a three loop diagram, you classify all the virtual lines in the diagram as carrying momenta that are either parametrically of the order Q1 or Q2, you impose momentum conservation in each vertex. So that, for example, two small momenta cannot give you a large momentum. You disregard these contributions that would violate momentum conservation. Then you would sort of select topologically not equivalent assignments. And topologically equivalent assignments are different from each other by some small shifts in the small momentum, okay, or large shifts in the large momentum. After that, you will basically tailor expand everything that can be expanded at the level of the integrand, and integrate using dimensional regularization, completely ignoring possible overlaps. Then you put together all the contributions, just add them, and you will get the correct result. So this is called the large momentum expansion. It was known, it is known for the past 20 years, and it actually is, well, actively used in various multi-loop calculations. Now let me just show you how this works in the one-loop case, because in the one-loop case, everything very easy to understand. So here is a one-loop diagram, and now this momentum K can be either of the order Q1 or of the order Q2, so either large or small. Once we choose an assignment for this momentum, everything else follows for momentum conservation. Now, if momentum K is parametrically of order Q1, so large, then in this diagram, there is one propagator that is small, that has this Q2, which is small compared to large K. So now we literally tailor expand this propagator in series, okay? And this is illustrated here because now, if this propagator becomes K tail expanded, then basically it's the same as this propagator. So we have a two-point function where the propagator 1 over K squared now is raised to some higher power, and the power increases once we go on and on in this expansion. If we now look at the second region, K of the order Q2, then there is this propagator where K is much smaller than Q1. So here, we should do the opposite. We should expand in K over Q1. And we just do this. Now, again, this removes this propagator from the picture. It becomes K independent, so to say. But this introduces higher and higher powers of K into what we can call an induced interaction vertex between these two currents. Now, clearly, there are more and more infrared divergences in these diagrams, And there are more and more UV divergences in these diagrams, in these contributions. Now, it turns out, and this is basically the statement that this is a valid method, that if you put those two things together and you completely ignore the overlaps, you know, at some point you have to integrate over K. Okay, and so naively you would think that you have to make sure that this K never goes to the region where Q2 was, where K is small, because this construction only worked for K being large. But you have to ignore this, and you have to ignore here the fact that K can be, you know, pretty large. And if you ignore this and you just add those two things together, you will get the right result. Okay, now.
Can you do the same thing for the Pauli Villars term?
No. I will do everything in dimensional regularization. Okay? So now, what is crucial in this construction is that all the integrals have to be carried out using dimensional regularization. And this, of course, implies that the original integrals have to be defined in dimensional regularization as well. Now, this leads to some, subtleties that I'll mention in the next slide. But basically, here is the important point. We now have an idea of how to map the three-point functions on two-point functions. And what we see is that these two-point functions need to be known sort of not only in the canonical form where this propagated in the first power and this propagated in the first power, but basically in the form where this can be an arbitrary power and this can be an arbitrary power. Now we do exactly the same thing for the three-loop contribution to the three-point function. And then it is clear that we'll be able to do this provided that we know how to calculate diagrams that are shown here. Now again, A1, A2, and A3, et cetera, these are just exponents of the corresponding propagators. So it turns out that this class of integrals is actually known. They were solved long ago by these three people using the idea, using the technique which is known as integration by parts. And the modern version of this solution is due to Vermaser and is implemented in a computer program Minsa. So this program basically can give you the result for an arbitrary three-loop two-point function, arbitrary in the sense that exponents can be arbitrary. So what we need to do is to sort of construct this algorithm that maps the three-point function into a two-point function. Once we have these two-point functions, we basically need to feed them to this program, and then it gives us the result. Now, as I said, everything needs to be defined in the dimensional regularization. So in particular, this also extends to the definition of the axial current. We need the definition of the axial current in dimensional regularization. It is, as you know, a little bit non-trivial because gamma 5 is not easily extended to higher or lower dimensions. There is a prescription by Hooft and Veltman of how to do this, but this prescription becomes totally impractical beyond one loop. And now, the useful idea was suggested some time ago by Laring, and is basically what is used in most of these multi-loop calculations these days. The idea is that that you can actually try to define some current that in four dimensions coincides with the axial current. This current should be, it should be possible to continue this current to d dimensions without additional ambiguities. And in general, if this is just some current, it will violate axial vector word identities. Now, that's okay because we can calculate the required counterterms, and this is what has been done. So basically, the current that people use to do these calculations now is shown here, and you see that basically, apart from this epsilon Levi-Civita tensor, the important part of this current is basically the product of three gamma matrices completely anti-symmetrized. So what you do, basically, you ignore this epsilon, completely removed from the picture, continue these guys to d dimensions, do everything that you need, get the final result, and then multiply this epsilon tensor back. Okay? Now, there is a finite renormalization of this current, even at the one-loop level. This is this same that Yagalina and Tarasov saw when they found that the result for the correlated two loops is proportional to the one loop, but with some non-trivial alpha S-dependent coefficient. So this is taken away by this factor. And after that, that's basically a very straightforward and useful and practical definition of the axial current. So you now put all this together, and you get already what Ite told us, that we'll find that the three loops, the QCD corrections to the correlator, are actually not zero. except they do not vanish for the three form factors, except for the WL, for the longitudinal one. The QCD corrections are indeed proportional to a one loop beta function, okay? And we explicitly can verify all the relations between different form factors that I showed you. And in particular, we can also verify that the Weinstein's equation for the longitudinal and transversal form factors, well, is correct through three loops, of course. It should be correct through any loop, whatever, but okay. So indeed, it seems that the reason we see this peculiar behavior in this correlator is the delayed violation of the conformal symmetry that appears only in the three loop level. So I don't know. I think so this is not the full result. I mean, there are other things as well, but basically, I need to put it on the slide somehow. So I don't know. I have a couple of more transparencies, but I can skip them and go to the conclusions, or I can, you know, discuss this, whatever you want.
Maybe we can do conclusions and all the possible.
Yeah. Okay. So basically the conclusions are very simple. So I basically try to talk to you a little bit about this particular Green's function, the correlator of two vector and one axial currents. As you all know, it played a very important historical role in the development of quantum field theory. And in recent years, we basically discovered a couple of new results. As far as this correlator is concerned, many of these developments were motivated by the physics of the non-anomalous magnetic moment. So the things that I basically try to mention in this talk are the perturbative non-renormalization of the transversal form factor in the chiral limit when one of the vector currents becomes soft. So this is the Weinstein's result. The longitudinal form factor equals twice the transversal form factor. This is seems to be an exact result in perturbative QCD. We have some symmetry relations between transversal form factors and longitudinal form factor in the generic kinematics case where Q1, Q2, and Q3 are arbitrary. And those relations, again, follow from this vector axial symmetry, which is corrected for the anomalous contribution. We understand now that the absence of two loop corrections to this correlator in the general kinematics is the consequence of the conformal symmetry that is still valid at two loops for this observable. And we have explicit verification that once we start going to the loop order in perturbative expansion QCD where you expect violation of the conformal symmetry, then basically it does happen. And the corrections to this correlator appear that are explicitly proportional to the one loop QCD beta function. So the things I didn't talk about, the extensions of this result to non-perturbative regime, and there basically what happens is that you can sort of still, so what happens is the following. You don't expect that this relation between longitudinal and transversal form factor survives in the non-perturbative regime, because if it survives, it would imply that there is a massless axial vector measurement QCD, which is not there. So somehow we should be able to see that non-perturbatively, the longitudinal form factor remains what it is, but the transversal form factor actually receives a mass, receives some sort of screening in the low Q squared regime. And one can actually do this and see how these things appear. One can also try to check the Sonia-Mamota relation. So the relation between this WL, WT, and the correlator of the vector currents and the axial currents separately. And there the situation is a little bit uneasy, so to say. This relation is definitely not entirely meaningless, let's put it like this. It actually, you know, many checks actually work out pretty well. But I think the jury to which extent it's actually true, completely true in QCD, is still out, and there is a lot of work happening in this direction. And so finally, let me just come back to where I started from. I think, as many of you know, there will be a new G-2 experiment at Fermilab, which has a very ambitious goals as far as the experimental uncertainty goes. And one of the important things that sort of always comes back in these discussions is whether or not theories can do a better job in understanding the hadronic light by light scattering that becomes important at a certain level. And well, part of the motivation for these discussions comes from the idea that maybe in one way or the other this will help in this respect, but how exactly this should happen is of course still completely open. So thank you very much. So, perturbatively, it's, you see, it depends. In the chiral limit, so this equation is supposed to be valid in some sense independent of the chiral limit. Now, in the chiral limit, this equation perturbatively is satisfied exactly. There are no right, there are no corrections to the left-hand side, and there are no corrections to the right-hand side. Okay, so perturbatively is satisfied perfectly in the chiral limit. If you go away from the chiral limit, then I'm not so sure what to say. There are, away from the chiral limit, that, I mean, there are claims that it is not satisfied, but I'm not sure to which extent these are correct claims.
It's, but away from the chiral limit, you don't really know whether
the quantum is away from the chiral, so this is another interesting thing. So at, away from the chiral limit, at the one loop level, you still have this relation. Remarkable. You don't have this argument. You can take gamma 5 and move it around, but you still have this relation. So now people were arguing that somehow miraculously this relation should stay valid in perturbative PCD away from the chiral limit. Now you can do explicit two-loop calculation for this one, and you actually get, so this should be two here, not one, but you actually get the result that, you know, they behave differently. So it's not an untrivial, it's not, how should I say, it's at this level, we know that there is a non-trivial left-hand side, away from the current. Now, I'm pretty sure there is a non-trivial right-hand side as well. What we don't know here is what to do with this F1. Okay. Now, there are suggestions in the literature to basically define f pi through this equation, but I don't know. If you do it like this, you define it like this, and then you pretend that you can calculate this quantity in perturbations here as well, you'll get a difference between left-hand side and right-hand side. But I don't know if this is a sensible definition of f pi. Okay, so in some sense, in the chiral limit, everything is trivial. You don't need the definition of f pi because left-hand side vanishes and right-hand side vanishes perturbatively. That's all. So it's a bit non-clear.
Because you know that this difference has to be equal to the vector function.
No.
But
not
something wrong, but just the.
This, but it's, well, it's not this difference, right? It's more complicated because in this limit there is nothing. This is not corrected in this limit. You have to go to an extended kinematics. Okay, to get this violation.
more questions.